I'm Carolyn Heldman. Welcome to a special edition of Cross Currents. During this special run of Cross Currents, I'll be speaking to the executive directors and presidents of all the major institutions in the Aspen area. The Aspen Music Festival and School, the Aspen Institute, Aspen Art Museum, and ACES. Tune in every Tuesday at 3:30. You can also hear all of them online at aspenpublicradio.org. On today's show, Dan Porterfield. He's the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute. With a career focus on promoting education equity and poverty prevention, in 2011, Porterfield became president of Franklin and Marshall College, where, under his tenure, the college tripled the percentage of Pell Grant-eligible students and reduced student indebtedness. Porterfield was also a senior VP and English professor at Georgetown University and senior aide to former U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala. He's been honored by the Kipp Foundation, I Have a Dream Foundation, and Posse Foundation, and the Obama White House named him one of 11 champions of change for college opportunity. I asked Porterfield to tell us about his childhood.
So I grew up in Baltimore City. My parents divorced when I was young. My mom went back to college in her 30s and raised me and my sister as a single mom. And I was the kind of kid that was pretty self-reliant without on my own a lot. So my mom was working, going to school at night, going to school in the summers. I also saw firsthand some pretty riveting social phenomena. We lived in an entirely African-American community. I identify as white for one period of time when I was little. Then we moved into an all-white working-class community about six blocks away. It was segregated time in Baltimore City history. That was an all-white neighborhood where everybody worked in McCormick Spices and Black & Decker and Sparrows Point. And then the neighborhood had the first families move in who were, the first family was African family, a doctor and his wife and two daughters. There was a good deal of protest and hatred directed towards that family from some of the people, the adults that lived in that neighborhood. And, you know, tomatoes thrown at their house and epithets written on their sidewalk. Soon there was really big white flight. Probably half the families moved out, and all the families that moved in were African American. And then the neighborhood stabilized and was a great integrated, fun place to grow up.
70s?
In the 70s, yeah. The public school that I was a part of went on shifts in seventh grade, and my mom got a note, your son's going to go to school 3.5 hours a day. You'll have to figure the rest out. No accountability at all. She was a working mom going to school at night. So she took me to a school in Baltimore County, a private school, on the first day of school, got them to take me and give me a scholarship for seventh grade. That was a school full of well-to-do families, a very, very preppy school. I was a city kid coming from a working class background. And so I had to learn a lot about how to adjust to this different kind of community. And so what I'm getting at is that growing up, I experienced a lot of transitions. Having a mom working, living in an entirely African-American neighborhood, living in a white neighborhood, segregation, seeing desegregation, seeing some violence and some hatred in that community, being the one low-income kid in a very wealthy school, all that shaped my sensibilities and made me care for and value the mindset and the thinking process and the emotions and the social worlds of young people. You know, Maya Angelou said, one reason why young people seem like they're tuned out so much is that they're recovering because when they think, they feel so deeply, they exhaust themselves. I really appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And I think young people have a great deal to offer our society. And so as soon as I was 15 years old, I shifted from sort of being a kid to being a mentor. I started coaching basketball teams in Baltimore City. I then went to college and I started working with court-supervised kids in Washington, D.C., whose, you know, lives were really at risk in the 80s as the crack wars were starting. And then I started working a little bit later as a young college graduate with recently arrived immigrant children, mostly from El Salvador and Guatemala, whose families walked or rode on the top of trains to get away from death squads and away from, you know, domestic violence. So I kept putting myself in a position to work with other young people of all backgrounds, many different ethnicities. And it was doing that that just gave me this feeling of constantly growing and feeling aware and feeling that I was making a contribution, and that was very rewarding. And so that's really an aspect of my values and of my personality that I've been able to sustain over these last 20 years of working in institutions and leading institutions.
So you've framed a legacy that you've left at Franklin and Marshall. I would not necessarily equate the Aspen Institute with youth empowerment or youth programming. I know there are several that I wasn't even aware of myself until doing a little bit of research. Is this a little window into what we can expect?
Absolutely. And there is great work going on. Not too long ago, we hosted this great convening of community leaders all around the country on our Aspen campus who flew in. They're all working with what are called opportunity youth, with young people who are at a transition moment where society can support them. They will be able to live productive lives. That was really inspiring. 300 people from around the country working in all sorts of communities. We have a program that focuses on Native American youth. We have another that focuses on community college students and helping create pathways to degrees. We have a program called the Ascend Program that takes a two-generation approach to poverty prevention, investing in the parents, moms and dads, as well as the kids together, so that the family unit feels a sense of thriving and movement forward for everybody. And that's still just scratching the surface. I think that the ASP Institute, one of the themes of the ASP Institute that runs through it actually is service to children, youth, and families, and of course the communities and cultures that from which they come. So you can count on me for sure to value that, to bring more youth speakers to the Aspen Ideas Festival stage, to, I hope, develop some new programs that foster youth leadership. We have some big ones around the country right now, like in Newark, the Mississippi Delta, and St. Louis, more to come. And to be looking at public policy solutions also out of our policy programs in D.C. that make investments in empowering young people to have self-determination, a good education, job skills, and the mindset to be civic leaders.
A window into the interview process, I suppose, was the for you to come in and replace Walter Isaacson as the CEO, president of the Aspen Institute. Was that a direction that the board or the search committee had decided upon, or are you affecting that because of how you came to be the new leader?
I think it's a little bit of both. As I understand it, the interview process was looking at finalists from all kinds of backgrounds, business, journalism, electoral politics, and then I was the one from higher education. It's a good thing there's only one, because there's a lot of great college presidents out there. And they, all throughout the interview process, I was asked about my values, my life experiences, and why I had chosen education over the last 20 years as the place to make my impact as a professor and as a college leader. Also, you know, I've published a bit about higher education issues and opportunity, the opportunity to expand enrollment of lower-income kids in top schools, and I've been on, you know, in the media a good bit. They were familiar with that, so they knew what I have worked on. At the same time, I also want to make sure that I'm able to continue to develop myself, I hope, as an impact maker and learn still more about climate change or about the evolving nature of work given technological disruptions or the, you know, critical unfolding importance of cybersecurity, protecting our democracy. A lot I'm going to learn in this job. And I competed for the job. It's a great opportunity to partner with Walter to help us take the next step in our development. The reason I wanted it in part was because I wanted to make an impact. I love the values of the Aspen Institute and of Aspen, Colorado. And also, I wanted to develop. I wanted to grow, too. Mm.
This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Carolyn Heldman. I'm speaking with Dan Porterfield. He's the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute, an international educational and policy studies organization based in Aspen and Washington, D.C. At Franklin and Marshall, under your tenure, the Pell Grant eligible students and color students of color,
basically
domestic
tripled.
Students tripled, yes. With the recent new Supreme Court, the elevation of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, there's conventional wisdom that slowly some more liberal policies in the United States are going to be hacked away, including affirmative action. Are you worried at all about that?
I don't know what the future of affirmative action will hold, but I do think that the approach that Franklin and Marshall has taken will withstand all kinds of scrutiny. And the reason I say that is that we developed our approach to enriching our student body, not as a diversity strategy, but as a talent strategy. Mm. We define systematically, based on evidence, the qualities of education and of character that predict high-level achievement at our school. And our school has a different ecosystem than other schools. Some of the qualities we looked for were success in a college prep curriculum. We also found that qualities like curiosity, perseverance, positive mindset, raising your hand and saying yes to opportunity, and having a vision of education all correlated to student success. Those qualities are talent. They are represented in equal measure all across our country. All you've got to do is get out of the ivory tower, get out to schools and programs, scholarship programs and access programs around the country, and to see where communities and educators are cultivating those qualities of talent in their young people. We found zero correlation between high test scores or low test scores and respectively college success or non-success at Franklin and Marshall College. Really does matter, though, are the things like time management, hard work, perseverance. These are qualities that are all over our country. And in fact, employers are the ones are looking for those qualities and kind of gave us some of the early read that what they valued in F&M kids were that they had a great work ethic. So we said, well, where else is there a great work ethic? Guess what? First generation college students have so much work ethic. It's inspiring to those that get to teach us. If the Supreme Court changes the law on affirmative action, it may not affect the Franklin and Marshall student body at all, because we barely rely upon test scores, only if you want to submit them, and because we have a very clear, well-defined theory of talent and a way of assessing talent. And that theory of talent does not require us to take into account ethnic identity.
What will those qualities look like at the Aspen Institute regarding talent, regarding values-based leadership, and how you're going to take that sort of bedrock principle of the Aspen Institute and try to, I'm using my hands in a wiggly way to sort of mimic a system that would spread out grassroots.
Thank you. One thing for sure is that we already run a great deal of policy programs and leadership programs that identify talent and that help talented young people and, you know, mid-career people make the best of opportunity and be able to grow professionally. We're already pretty good at that. Our leadership development programs are well recognized. In terms of building the Aspen staff, I think that we will work even harder to find highly motivated, positive colleagues from around the country with perhaps a little more emphasis on recruiting in new spaces so that our workforce becomes a little more inclusive of experience, whether that's the experience of people who live and work with a disability or the diversity of viewpoint or of life history, urban, rural, suburban backgrounds, or race and ethnicity or religion. All those will be factors. The way I think of it is that you recruit talent. It's about talent. You have to know what talent you're looking for, but then when you recruit, you should recruit very inclusively. And the third thing is to measure impact. I think inclusive teams tend to be stronger than homogenous teams because there's more perspectives. They're able to think about the diverse society we have with more experiences to draw upon. They may well be able to connect to more resources as partners because they have a diversity of professional backgrounds. And our job at the Aspen Institute must be to have disproportionate positive social impact towards creating a flourishing society.
This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Carolyn Heldman. I'm speaking with Dan Porterfield. He's the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute, an international educational and policy studies organization based in Aspen and Washington, D.C. In public media, we're having a charge to try to bring people together from diverse backgrounds and diverse perspectives to discuss important issues of the day, much like you do, at least in particular at the Aspen Ideas Festival. The tenor of today's discussions has become so divisive and so rancorous. We find it even 6 months, a year ago, it's even more pronounced and difficult to have people convened to discuss issues without running to their corners and throwing punches. Does that trouble you? Do you see that in your work, and is that a problem for the Ideas Festival in particular, or the Aspen Institute at large? And what do you see you could do to combat that?
I think it's a problem for all institutions in American society. And one reason why we have the challenge we have of political polarization is that many of our institutions have not been accountable to the broader public. The finance industry, the bank industry, obviously, the Catholic Church. There's tremendous frustration with law enforcement in some areas. I wouldn't paint the media with anything close to a broad brush, but there's obviously been some behavior by organizations that call themselves news organizations that really have not actually been objectively pursuing truth where it leads. And so there's a cynicism people feel about institutions and their ability to deliver. The government, of course, is an object of that cynicism. And then secondly, there's fear. I think a lot of the anger we hear in people's voices comes down to a great concern that they won't be able to enjoy the quality of life they want, they won't be respected for the person they are, and that the country is not focused on delivering for sort of its core community, its core citizens. I think that journalism has a massive role to play and is doing a great job at the level of the really professional outlets that are trying their best to cover all sides of the stories and to bring forward some of the problem solvers and solution finders, as well as some of the louder voices. I think I really feel that public radio does a great job at bringing more light and not just more heat to the debate around the issues of the day. In fact, I think the Aspen Institute can and should do more to advocate for the media to almost re-disseminate some of the great stories by media about what's happening in the country, and to use our, I think, relatively strong position in society right now, respected as a nonpartisan entity, to make sure that we stand up for the core principles of freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, freedom of political belief, and the sort of like the separation of powers and the checks and balances that have made our democracy largely successful, although by no means perfect, over more than 200 years. So part of what I hope to do with the Aspen Institute is to help us shine a still greater spotlight on many of the great journalists and news outlets working today, including, of course, Aspen Public Radio, which brings so much quality content to the people of Aspen, Colorado, not just about national issues, but now under your leadership about the local issues that really are important to people, bread and butter issues, cultural issues, community issues that really matter for our town, for this city.
On the one side, I'm starting to get a picture of the values-based leadership that the Aspen Institute provides, seminars. If we can teach kids and organizations to come together as a community that we can lift up together, how would you do that?
I think that there's a couple ways. But one, first of all, one of the Aspen programs that works a lot with kids is a citizenship project led by a colleague named Eric Liu, Eric's core belief is that we don't need fewer arguments, we need better arguments, mm-hmm. where people learn to debate and discuss using evidence, being able to accurately restate the other person's position, being able to absorb the argument of another person and modify their argument based on what was said, that you can teach the skills of listening and discussion in a way that makes the intensity of an argument a richer intensity. That's one point. Aspen Institute also has this great program called Sport and Society. It's all about trying to promote equity of play around the country. We just put out recently a report on Mobile, Alabama. We're constantly putting out reports where the business community, the school community, the parent and religious communities get together and the athletic communities and say, how do we get more kids exercising, more kids on teams, more kids going to other parts of the city because they're playing games in other areas? And the point here is that part of a great civic life is being able to bring students together, young people together, across the supposed divides of zip code or of background. And athletics is a good way to do that. It's not the only way, but it's a good way. It's an important way. So my point would be then that partly we should be working with young people to be able to have better arguments, but partly we should just get them mashing it up together, making things together, whether it's businesses or that they make together or camp experiences they make together or athletics programs they are able to compete in together or school learning enrichment activities they can do together. And there I see the ASP Institute in the coming years creating more youth programming.
Did you read a recent column, the David Brooks column about good news? It's in Spartanburg. You were talking about Birmingham, I think, or
Mobile.
Mobile. The Spartanburg academic movement. It's organized around a philosophy of collective impact. It's approaching youth. You know it.
Yep.
Okay.
I have to say something fun. David Brooks now works for the ASP Institute.
He does.
Yes, 20 hours a week. This column comes out of work he's doing with us. And what we've done is we have recruited him and funded him with a team that he's built to travel the country, to go all kinds of places, north, south, east, and west, and to figure out who are the change makers in any given community who are working together without an us versus them mentality, whatever that might mean. Mm. And then he goes and visits what they're doing. He gathers up a group for lunch or dinner of those kinds of change makers. He listens to what's on their mind. Often they express a tremendous amount of anger about the national discourse. And then when they talk about their local work, they light up, they express a calling, they speak with an extraordinary humility, and believe that others are making a greater difference than themselves. And they seem to put the call to create local community above even the anger of sort of national dialogue, national enmity. And so what David's going to do is gather up all these different change makers, like the ones he wrote about, and bring them together for a big convening. So people that work on reservations and people that work at downtown LA and other people that are working in rural communities can see each other, can look across the table, can see somebody else just like them committed to difference making without dividing. He synthesizes this sort of people power that's anonymous, that's humble, that's difference making, that's real, that's quintessentially American, practical, and that we need to be able to know and name better so that when one group is looking at a shouter, we can shift eyes and say, well, here's a builder. I think David's going to do great work with Aspen on this way.
I'm going to refer to, he quotes Wendell Berry in that column. Yeah. He says, the disease of modern character is specialization. How do you read that?
I think that we, you hear that great Wordsworth quote, we murder to dissect, that sometimes our ones and individuals' advanced knowledge pursued all the way as far as it can go has significant value to the cultural reservoir and intellectual reservoir of a nation, but has the adverse and unintended effect of making a person so specialized that she or he is removed from the ability to relate to people that don't have that degree of sort of like really fine-honed expertise. And that, I think, can be a problem for communication. We hear the jargon or the language that comes out of excessive specialization. And if you're a normal person, you say, well, I don't know what that doctor is talking about. Or I don't know why that business person uses concepts I'd never heard of before. Or why that professor has this whole way of speaking that seems so like self-confident, but yet I don't know what she's saying. And I think all of us need to work, need to work to try to boil down the most important ideas we have in such a way so that they can be pitched where others can catch them, understandable language.
This is Cross Currents on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Carolyn Heldman. I'm speaking with Dan Porterfield. He's the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute, an international educational and policy studies organization based in Aspen and Washington, D.C. Having children the same age roughly as yours who just went through the gauntlet of the application process of college a few years ago, specialization, it seems to me, at higher education anyway, is required these days. And so if you would disagree with me, if you will, but if not, is this another one of those test scores optional futures that we're trying to hope to see.
Fortunately, there's 4,000 colleges in the country, and there's a wide range of places and types, and there's a fit for everybody. I'm very partial to one model of education for those who want it, which is a smaller school, you know, 2,000 to 2,500 in size, with a liberal arts curriculum, and where the faculty teach at the level of general knowledge. And while they're doing research, they're not teaching at the level of advanced knowledge. And because there's no graduate school, there's thus no graduate students taking the place of faculty teaching undergraduates, but it's a direct, unmediated sort of scholar-to-student experience, but with the starting point being where is the student, not where is the scholar. And I think that model of general education where you read, you know, literature, political theory, economics, science, math, language, it's called a liberal arts curriculum. It's really a great way for a developing adult to get the grounding in the core disciplines, to read some of the masterworks, to be able to ask the enduring questions of life early, and to have ownership of the campus, to be able to run the clubs and play on the teams and change sophomore year and do something totally different if she wants. And that model of engagement, of a student engagement, is at risk in America as big schools get bigger and as small schools struggle to try to be able to afford a more personalized education for you know, highly engaged students. I really believe that the critical feature that young people need is the involvement of caring adults in their lives. Ben Franklin once wrote, "Tell me and I forget, teach me and I know, involve me and I learn." And so the higher education institutions that best enable students to be active, involved learners, whether they're bigger schools or smaller schools, are the ones that impress me the most.
And the final, involve me and I learn, I would say is maybe a motto that you'll be taking forward into the Aspen Institute for the next 10 years.
Well, you know, I always like to like not make promises that I might not be able to deliver, but I am writing a book right now about how young people can thrive with the combination of great access to education and work opportunities and the active mentoring of adults. And the book is called Involve.
Perfect. Before I let you go, one last bit, because I'm sort of framing this around my time here and asking people to reflect on their legacies. You just got there. We've got a long legacy with Walter. What do you hope to be your legacy when you move on from the Aspen Institute?
I really don't have any hope at all for a legacy. What I want to do is work with the 500 or so colleagues who are a part of the Aspen Institute, the 70-some board members, and then the thousands of stakeholders in Aspen, Colorado, and all around the country that value the Aspen Institute, so that we together can chart our future and make the biggest and best impacts that we can make to improve our society consistent with the values of the Aspen Institute and this wonderful history. So, you know, my legacy would be one member of the team contributing to the realization of a bold vision for difference making in society.
Dan Porterfield, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Great to be here, Carolyn.
That'll do it for Cross Currents for today. You can hear this show again on Sunday at 1:30 or on our website at aspenpublicradio.org. Next week, I speak to news director Allison Bechtesh with memories of Cross Currents in the past 10 years at Aspen Public Radio. Thanks for listening. Marketplace coming up next.